Iran's leader says entire Palestine has turned into a stage for resistance against Israel, invalidating all plots aimed at compromise with the regime. People around the world hold rallies to mark International Quds Day in solidarity with Palestinian struggle against Israeli occupation. And Israeli forces kill another Palestinian youth in an attack on a town near the city of Qalqilia in occupied West Bank. Hello, everyone. Thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story, leader of the Islamic Revolution, says the entirety of Palestine has today turned into a stage for resistance, dealing a death blow to all plots aimed at compromise with Israel. In a speech delivered in Arabic on the occasion of International Quds Day, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said an invincible willpower in Palestine and throughout West Asia has replaced the so-called invincible Israeli army. He said while Israel has now been forced on the defensive, the regime's chief ally, the United States, has suffered consecutive defeats such as in Afghanistan and against Iran. He praised the resistance of the Palestinian people, stressing they're united in continuing this struggle on the path of God against the Israeli regime. The leader warned that while Israel is short of breath, it keeps committing crimes and killing innocent people. Ayatollah Khamenei censored the silence of so-called advocates of human rights in Europe and the U.S. in the face of such crimes. The Secretary General of Hezbollah says a Lebanese resistance movement, along with other resistance groups in the region, is ready to confront Israeli aggression in Al-Quds. Our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, has more from Beirut.
Lebanese resistance movement Hezbollah held a rally to commemorate International Quds Day. Secretary General of the resistance movement Sayed Hassan Nasrallah addressed the gathering, stressing that the latest individual operations by Palestinians have once again shown the weakness of the Israeli regime, while proving that the Palestinian people have not forgotten their cause, but have rather become more hopeful in the liberation of their land.
The Palestinians told the Israelis over the past weeks that they cannot occupy Palestine and still enjoy security. The military confrontations have proven to be capable of achieving victories and defeating the enemy, and this path must continue. Liberating Palestine might not need great armies or weapons, but rather martyrdom fighters.
Sayed Nasrallah also warned the Israelis that any uncalculated move during their military drills in May will lead to a direct retaliation from Hezbollah.
When the Israeli exercises begin, the resistance in Lebanon will be at the highest levels of alert and readiness. We tell the Israeli enemy not to bet on exhaustion or hunger or poverty. Any act of foolishness will be met with an immediate response.
The leader of the resistance in Lebanon once more reiterated the regional strategy that any assault on Al-Quds will lead to a regional war. Palestinians in Lebanon also attended the rally in Beirut and held several gatherings in refugee camps. They also were vocal in asserting that they are with the pro-armed struggle.
We tell our people, the youth of Al-Quds, where 250,000 have gathered to fortify and defend this holy site. They are defending the dignity of the entire nation. Today, we are commemorating this day not only in solidarity, but we are commemorating with the sword of Al-Quds. We are the children of the sword. We are the sons of the resistance and the front of the resistance. And with resistance, we shall liberate Al-Quds and defend human dignity.
Despite being away from their homeland, Palestinian refugees said their hearts and minds are with their people.
International Quds Day is seen by many across the globe as a day to denounce Israeli oppression and occupation of Palestinian land. For Palestinians in the diaspora, it is a day to renew their decades-long struggle to return to their homeland. Mariam Saleh, Beirut.
Like many people around the world, Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have rallied on International Quds Day to express their anger at Israel. Ashraf Shannon brings us the following story out of Gaza.
Palestinians in the besieged Gaza Strip rallied on Friday to mark International Quds Day. Millions of people around the world hold rallies every year to mark this day, which takes place on the last Friday of the holy Muslim month of Ramadan, to support the people of Palestine. Protesters shouted slogans against the Israeli regime and demanded an end to the Israeli occupation. The big event was organized by the Islamic Jihad movement.
Today we mark International Quds Day, while freedom fighters from Gaza, Yemen, Tehran, Lebanon and Syria, as well as in other places around the world, stand united for the sake of Al-Quds.
International Quds Day was declared in 1979 by the founder of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, the late Ayatollah Khomeini, to drum up international solidarity for the Palestinian people. People at the rally expressed their gratitude to Imam Khomeini for his historic initiative.
On International Quds Day, we say to the whole world that we are willing to sacrifice our lives for the sake of Al-Quds. We also want to express our deepest gratitude to the Islamic Republic of Iran and Imam Khomeini for this important occasion in solidarity with Al-Quds.
Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque have a special place in the hearts of millions of Muslims around the world due to its religious status. Extremist Jewish settlers backed by Israeli forces have been violating the sanctity of the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in recent days.
Imam Khomeini's designation of this day is of great importance because it unites all resistance fronts for the sake of supporting Palestine and Al-Quds. These fronts are united today more than ever to help secure the liberation of Al-Quds.
International Quds Day is observed in over 80 countries around the globe.
Observers say the international community has failed to help the Palestinians and has turned a blind eye to the Israeli violations against them for decades. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The International Quds Day has been observed across Pakistan, with people showing solidarity with Palestinians and expressing anger at Israeli aggression at the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Mohammad Touri reports from Karachi.
Fury in the streets of Pakistan. In their tens of thousands across the country, these supporters of Palestinian converged at the city center to show solidarity with wounded and traumatized Palestinians who face Israeli atrocities on a daily basis.
Decades after Imam Khomeini declared the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan as International Quds Day, people across the globe, including Pakistan, continue to show support for Palestinian cause.
Protesters slammed what they called the criminal silence of international community and their failure to denounce the Israeli regime.
We've gathered here to celebrate Al-Quds Day, which was commanded by Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah alayh. According to him, it's the day of Islam, it's the day of God, and whoever does not celebrate this day, whoever does not commemorate Al-Quds Day, is an agent of Israel and an agent of the Zionist regime.
We are here because Palestine is under oppression of Israel.
Leaders at the rally also condemned the U.S. support for Israel and stressed upon the need for unity among Muslims to support Palestinian resistance.
As Muslims, our leader Imam Khomeini, he has urged all the Muslims to come forward on Jumat al-Wida to show our support for the Palestinians. We are here to show our solidarity with the Palestinian cause. Israel has illegally oppressed them and taken their land, which is legally theirs.
We are here to stand for the people of Palestine. We are here because Imam Khomeini, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, has declared this day as International Day for the oppression in the world. Those nations who are being oppressed in the world, we stand for them here.
Speakers also expressed anger at some Arab countries over normalizing ties with Israel. Mohammed Touri, Karachi.
And people have rallied in the British capital to mark International Quds Day and voice support for Palestinians. Bianca Rahimi has your details from London.
Another Quds Day, another worldwide cry for the end to Israeli crimes in occupied Palestine. From Iran to Iraq to London, over the weekend, thousands turned up in the British capital to call once more for an end to Israel's crimes against humanity. And on Friday, a bus emblazoned with messages calling on people to join the campaign for a free Palestine. On board were representatives of the Jewish community and clergy who say Zionism has hijacked their faith.
Zionism this raising anti-Semitism over the world. Zionism with the acts by the killings, in the robbery of the land, from in the killing of innocent women and children, this raise anti-Semitism over the world. So Zionism doesn't save Jews at all.
As a daughter of people who survived the Holocaust, it's very important that every nation should have learned by that and learned about freedom. And how dare Jews who suffered, how dare they do the same to the Palestinians as what happened to their parents? I think it's absolutely beyond disgusting.
Carol, a Jew in the eighth decade of her life, says she is confident she will see Palestine free in her lifetime.
And this is a sentiment shared here in London and around the world, that the last apartheid on earth is about to end and justice is just around the corner for the Palestinians.
Also passionate about the Palestinian plight are Black Lives Matter activists, who say their cause has historic links to the anti-occupation movement in the occupied Palestinian territories.
I think that one day Palestine will be free, and I think it's important for us to keep up that fight. You know, I remember, and I can only equate it to South Africa. They said it could never happen. They said black people could never be free. Nelson Mandela, the idea of him being a prime minister or president was impossible. And that's what they've said about Palestine, but we are still here. And the thing is, we're not going to stop fighting and campaigning and marching and protesting until they are free.
The annual Quds Day March comes in the wake of repeated attacks on Masjid al-Aqsa and Gaza throughout the holy month of Ramadan. Young and old were being targeted, hundreds were arrested, at least 150 Palestinians were injured and 19 killed. Calls are growing louder every year for the international community to force an end to the occupation, which is not a matter of if, but when. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Israeli forces kill another Palestinian as the regime's crimes continue in the occupied territories on a daily basis. Palestinian Health Ministry said 27-year-old Palestinian was killed after being shot by Israeli forces in a town near the West Bank city of Qalqilia. The incident came hours after an Israeli security guard was killed in the West Bank. According to the Israeli military, two people opened fire on a security post near the aerial settlement, killing the guard before escaping the scene in a vehicle. Israeli forces are currently searching for the attackers. No person or group has yet claimed responsibility. The Hamas resistance group in a statement hailed the attack, saying it's part of our people's response to attacks on the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Incidents come amid the regime's intensified crackdown throughout the West Bank. The Al-Aqsa Mosque in Al-Quds has been a flashpoint, with Israeli forces launching brutal attacks on Palestinian worshippers during the holy fasting month of Ramadan. Now, veteran Iranian director Nader Talibzadeh has passed away at the tender age of 69. Talibzadeh, who was hospitalized for some time for complications from heart disease, suffered heart failure. He was a documentary filmmaker, producer, TV presenter, and cinema director. Talibzadeh was also blacklisted by the U.S. for organizing the New Horizons International Conference. The annual event is a platform for criticism of policies of the U.S. and Israel. And now joining us is Scott Bennett, former U.S. Army Psychological Warfare Officer from San Francisco, California. And hope you're doing well out there in Northern California. Your initial thoughts on the passing of Nader Talibzadeh?
Well, it's a very sad day, of course. And I loved Nader very deeply. He was like an uncle to me. I cherished his memory, and I was so honored to have been invited to the New Horizons Conference. And I know he has been deeply loved by all of us who went to that conference. All of my colleagues had nothing but honor and affection and deep respect for him because of his peacefulness and his desire for dialogue and conversation and truth and bringing healing to the relationship between Iran and America. And he was a bridge that brought us to Iran myself and Phil Giraldi and Michael Maloof and Michael Springman so many of the great men here in America that I know and work with, they all cherished and adored Nader Talebzada because he was a profound intellect. There will be no man that could match his memory, no man who could come near his statesmanship, his diplomacy, his ability to bring people together to analyze things and to have a good sense of humor at the same time, but a man of deep feeling and deep poetry, and only the suffering he experienced earlier in life gave him great wisdom. And I was so profoundly saddened that the American government had the mendacity and the wickedness to try and put on restraints against us from going back to the New Horizons conference, because they knew if there was one conference and one man that could heal the relationship between America and Iran and start anew, it was Nader Talebzada. And I think we all honor him, and we will always strive to honor his memory by doing what he wanted, and that is to at last bring Americans and Iranians together in fellowship, in affection, and friendship. And I will make that always part of my mission in honor of Nader and his dear wife, Zeina. So I'm very sad because I loved him deeply, and I know all of you did too.
Thank you, Scott. Stay safe, Scott Bennett. This was an extended conversation on the passing of Nader Talebzada at the tender age of 69. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
The U.S. House Select Committee investigating the Capitol attack said that Donald Trump's former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, went ahead with plans to have Trump speak at the Ellipse rally that descended into the Capitol attack only days after being expressly told by the U.S. Secret Service that there was potential for violence on January 6, 2021. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written jointly by Hugo Lowell and Ramon Antonio Vargas, titled Mark Meadows Was Warned of Illegality of a Scheme to Overturn U.S. 2020 Election. Please stay with us to hear more about the story. The U.S. House Select Committee investigating the Capitol attack said on Friday, April 22nd, Donald Trump's former chief of staff, Mark Meadows, was warned the effort to overturn the 2020 election with fake electoral college votes was not legally sound and yet proceeded anyway. In a court filing, the panel also said that Meadows went ahead with plans to have Trump speak at the Ellipse rally that descended into the Capitol attack only days after being expressly told by the U.S. Secret Service that there was potential for violence on January 6, 2021. The 248-page court filing could serve to increase the legal exposure for Meadows. It aims to portray Meadows as someone who was instrumental in trying to overturn the outcome of the election that Trump lost to Biden. The charges, based on testimony from former White House staffer Cassidy Hutchinson, suggested that Meadows knowingly acted in an unlawful manner. The panel said Hutchinson testified that Pat Cipollone, who was the White House counsel at the time, told Meadows that Trump's attorney Rudy Giuliani that the scheme to have a state send Trump slates of electors to Congress in states that he lost in 2020 election was not legally sound. The filing said Hutchinson testified that she had White House attorneys tell Meadows and other officials, including certain but unspecified congressmen, that trying to certify a Trump win in that manner did not comply with the law and was not legally sound. Nonetheless, it said Meadows participated in a widely publicized call with the top election official in Georgia, the Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, and other related efforts seeking to change the election results there. Hutchinson, who worked in Meadows' office, also testified in a separate deposition that Meadows knew about the potential for violence on January 6, 2021, after being briefed on intelligence reports by the Secret Service. She said, "I know that people had brought information forward to Meadows that had indicated that there could be violence on the 6th. Hutchinson said Meadows had been presented with the warnings either one or two ways before the Capitol attack took place. She said former White House Chief of Operations Anthony Ornato delivered them to Meadows in his office. Hutchinson told the Select Committee in the first of her two dispositions, one in February and another in March, we had intel reports saying that there could potentially be violence on the 6th. Douglas Leder, the general counsel for the House of Representatives, in the court filing wrote, but despite this and other warnings, President Trump urged attendees at the January 6th rally to march to the Capitol to take back your country. The Select Committee's investigation into the Capitol riot and its aftermath has been investigating whether Trump and his staffers illegally conspired with the extremists who stormed the Capitol as Congress was certifying Biden's presidential victory. It has also been examining whether Trump and members of his administration broke federal laws prohibiting obstruction of a congressional proceeding, which in this case would be the interrupted certification session. As part of that probe, the committee subpoenaed records from Meadows' cell phone service provider Verizon, among others. Though he has turned over at least some communications to the committee, Meadows sued to stop those subpoenas, portraying them as overly broad and cumbersome. The Select Committee included excerpts of Hutchinson's testimony in an effort to persuade the district court in Washington, D.C. to reject that lawsuit. If granted, the Select Committee's motion for summary judgment could finally cap a protracted legal battle with Trump's final White House chief of staff. It has detailed the numerous ways Meadows was involved in Trump's efforts to overturn his 2020 election defeat, including the scheme to put forward alternate slates of electors for Trump in states that he lost. The Guardian has previously reported the aim of the scheme was to have then-Vice President Mike Pence declare at the joint session of Congress on January 6, 2021, that he could not count the states with the slates for both Trump and Joe Biden and return Trump to office. The panel's chair, Congressman Betty Thompson, and Vice Chair, Congresswoman Liz Cheney, said in a statement, "The Select Committee's filing today urges the court to reject Mark Meadows' baseless claims and put an end to his obstruction of our investigation." Much of the panel's new revelations late on Friday, April 22nd, cited testimony from Hutchinson, who was present for key discussions in the White House in the weeks before the Capitol attack. Hutchinson testified after she was issued a subpoena in November. She also recounted how the White House counsel's office had threatened to resign if Trump went ahead with an extraordinary plan to seize voting machines and assert emergency presidential powers over false claims of election fraud. She said of Meadows, once it became clear that there could be mass resignations, including lawyers in the White House counsel office, including some of the staff that Mr. Meadows worked closely with, you know, I know that did factor into this thinking. The former Trump White House aide, who served as a special assistant to the president for legislative affairs, testified that some members of Congress, such as Scott Perry, who is now the chair of the right-wing House Freedom Caucus, supported sending people to the Capitol on January 6, 2021. Testimony from Hutchinson and other aides also corroborated the Senate Judiciary Committee report that found Trump unsuccessfully sought the imprimatur of the Justice Department to bolster his claims of election fraud. Meadows initially cooperated with the inquiry before abruptly withdrawing his assistance last year. He turned over a trove of evidence that included an email in November 2020 discussing appointing alternate slates of electors and others about overturning the 2020 election. But the filing said he then proceeded to withhold more than 1,000 other messages on his personal phone over executive privilege claims. He also refused to appear for a deposition, reversing a cooperation deal agreed between his lawyer and the Select Committee. In response, the House referred Meadows, who was the top official in the Trump administration, for prosecution for contempt of Congress, though the Justice Department has yet to issue charges.
This is Back to Reality. Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us on today's brand new episode of Back to Reality. I have the honor and privilege of being joined by my brothers in faith and humanity. To the right, I have the one and only Brother Habib. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you for having me here. It's always an honor and a pleasure. And to my right,
assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. And thank you for having me, Abdullah Al-Musawi.
Thank you so very much for joining us, gentlemen. Gentlemen, if you could just have a brief introduction of yourselves and your field of study, just for our listeners who've recently joined our program or those who've been with us for a really long time but have somehow forgotten.
Brother Habib, at your service. I'm studying in the Hausa. I've been studying for 10 years, Mashallah. Which is a long time for,
it is,
to some extent.
To be studying anything, really.
Yeah, and...
And Brother Abdullah?
Well, I am in the same boat as Brother Habib. We kind of started together in Hausa. Maybe he was like a year before me.
I was a year before you.
Yeah. So we both students of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
Have you recently come across a clip or a tweet or a quote or even some sort of personal interaction with someone in your circle that made you feel, faith in humanity restored? Do you think it's a this century phenomenon or it's just a personal thing you're going through?
I think that society altogether is busy and incorporated with their time and themselves. They don't have enough time for interaction with other human beings.
Nowadays?
And the only interaction that we're having is digital. And, you know, that wholesome thing that you're trying to point out to is pretty much like a like or a comment. And how do you distinguish between the fake ones and the real ones?
Do you not get satiated by that? Do you not get satisfied by something?
At all. Never in my life have I ever thought about how many likes have I got, how many things. One thing I do look at is that are people criticizing me because I want to see where I did, if I did something wrong and if I can fix it or no, people are just, you know.
Being jerks.
Mm. Trolls.
Sayyid, do you agree with Brother Habib that nowadays people are drifting apart, becoming more self-centered? Or do you think it's rather the opposite, that there's been a higher growth in people's awareness and they are connecting with each other from across continents on a deeper level?
There are two things here. Being connected to others, yes, this is more. People are more connected because the whole world is a small village.
Yep.
But where the people care, I think that's becoming a lot less.
Did they ever care, though?
Back in the days, yes, people used to care about humanity in general. They used to have feelings for one another.
Even for their friends, their neighbors, you know, how much people used to care for their neighbors.
But then the population of the earth was like one-third of what it is now. People could afford to care about each other.
It's the core values of a human being towards another human being. That core value now was either changed, being manipulated, or either it's declining. Some people, you see them, obviously, due to the environment that they live in. Either they don't care about humanity in general, they don't care what happens to people. They sit on the news and they eat their dinner as they watch millions of people or hundreds or thousands of people getting killed. Mm-hmm. And they just don't care. They just don't, you know, blink an eye. So which means that humanity is gone. And some people, they pick and choose who to be emotional and sympathetic towards, like Ukraine and Russia people, or Ukrainians. But no one cared about millions of Yemenis who are dying on a daily basis. True. No one cared about Syria. So where's the humanity in that? That's a human hypocrisy. So humanity itself, in terms of humanity, is decreasing in like rapidly. In terms of connection, obviously social media connecting everyone, but being connected to a person doesn't mean that you have any sympathy towards them. I have over 1,000 people followers on my Instagram or on my Facebook. It doesn't mean I love them. It doesn't mean they love me. They don't even know who I am. I don't even know who they are. So because we are connected, it doesn't mean anything. But in terms of real value in the ground, what are you doing towards your fellow human beings? I think that's absolutely decreasing. So we have seen a lot of clips where you see someone doing act that, you know, emotionally makes you feel good.
Warm or, and fuzzy on the inside.
Yeah, or it makes you like, you know, sometimes even you might tear up to a scene. But these are just isolated, limited events.
Examples.
Because sometimes in some countries, actually in some system, in Australia, for example, where I'm from, if someone is dying in front of you, you should not touch them. You have no right to approach them. If someone got in a car accident and you go to them, you're in trouble.
Yeah, but I'm pretty sure Australia has always been like this. So it's not
always. But that concept now is applied in Iraq too.
Yeah, but it's not a 21st century concept for Australia.
No, but it's the concept of humanity that if you see someone on the road being hit or someone injured, you say, I'm not going to touch them. I'm not going to approach them. It's not my problem. I mean, where's the humanity? That's what I'm saying.
Are they not? Are they saying? Are you really saying that you see someone in a car crash, their car totally flipped over at the side of the street, and you're driving in Australia? You're just going to drive past without even, I don't know what 911 is in Australia.
000.
Without even dialing 000 because you might get into trouble?
No. People dial, but what did
exactly.
they come
what
to
else are they supposed
another.
To do? Try it's- to yank a.
No, I
a
mean,
person with
I,
look,
I gave
ruptured
you an example,
spine.
So not, let's not focus on the example itself. I'm just saying, in generally speaking, humanity is decreasing in people. They just become self-centered. They have self-egoism.
Thank you.
Brother Habib, do you think there's a fundamental reason for this self-centeredness?
It's either it's one of two people are looking at their self first of all, and they're saying they're not seeing the sufficiency of life in themselves. Like, for example, I have to work more, I have to gain this. And it really just pops up the question when you see someone else in trouble. Like, all right, when I'm in trouble, are people going to look at me or not? That's the first thing. Second thing is that, is this worth my time or not? You know, there's always that question that pops up to my people's mind when they see other conflicts.
So they're driven by benefit, basically.
Yeah, it really goes back to this, because they're not sufficient with the benefits. They're not benefiting enough from this world. They want to benefit more. And that's because that's the idea of capitalism, you know, where people, you know, we're going to reach a point, if we remain on this status, trust me, that husband and wife will not even know each other very well.
I don't know why do I not see it the way you guys do.
You're seeing that humanity is being better?
Yeah. Because...
That's the hypocrisy of social media. That's the hypocrisy of this democratic liberal ideas that are available. But all of them are based on self-desires for a specific group of people. And you want experience, go ahead and live in the United States. And go ahead and live in places like East Los Angeles, where there are various cultures over there, or the poor parts of Los Angeles, and look how people are living there.
Yeah, because no, poverty has always been
there. Not about poverty. I'm talking even about laws, about how they deal with the people, with the system altogether.
Yeah, the system.
You're saying that we're for humanity and we're for everything. Where's humanity been when there's wars? The Rwanda genocide in the 90s. In the 90s. No one looked at it. No one batted an eye.
Even now, look at many
Palestine. Look at Yemen. Look at Syria.
Yeah, but you speak as if all of these are 21st century phenomena, when war and famine and poverty and slaughter and massacre and genocide has been going on since the beginning of history of mankind.
No,
the population
now,
of Earth was four people, and yet they killed each other.
In Ukraine, you know what they're saying? You know what they're saying in Ukraine on TV, on national TV? They're saying that we cannot stand the fact that people with blue eyes and blonde hair
are being
refugees. Mm. See, that really, Trevor Noah said something very nice the other day. He said that refugee is not a color. Mm. Now they understand, because refugee, whenever you say refugee, they had this tabadur, this insaraf to a person being a brown person.
What does that mean, tabadul insaraf?
The first thing that pops up to your mind when
you goes to
you know, like people
thing.
Who are brown or Muslim, right? That's the idea of a refugee.
See, the thing is, brother, in response to what you're saying, genocide and war and famine has been happening since the creation of man. Habil killed his brother Qabil. So that's, we're not talking about that. Now what's happening is that there are systems into play that making the majority of people lose their humanity. Unlike before it used to be wars between tribes or between, I don't know, countries, of, you know, they invade each other. But the majority of people, they have no beef with one another. Now, because I am, you know, from the United States, I would care about my own people. And I don't care if the rest of the world burns.
It's always been like that. See, back then, a tribe constituted of 500 people. And now it's 500 million people.
The scale that is happening, and now it's happening on a massive scale, where you have millions of people having the same ideology. That's a problem.
And now the kindness has increased in accordance with that scale.
What kind of kindness? Are you talking about the kindness where they take videos and they become famous, and if they want to help out, they have to be on the camera? Is that the kindness that you're talking about?
Obviously not.
What kind of kindness then? I haven't seen this kindness. I'm not saying that there's no such thing as kindness out there.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that this concept of being very vast and very and well known to people is, no, it's not available. It's not available.
So there are.
Are we going to deny? You know, we can't. Yeah, you can't deny reality. There is kindness,
definitely.
But the vast amounts.
If you do the scales, if you do the statistics, which one weighs more? When we see that there are less humanity in people than those who have a humanity, that's what the point we're trying to get across.
Yeah, and we're not trying to get people to.
If you
in
say
despair.
That the world's a better place, khair inshallah.
I think it sometimes boils down to our definition of what kindness is. And also what we choose to focus on. Things such as oppression and even a degree of capitalism have always been there. But we still cannot deny the fact that during the 21st century, because of many factors and variants that have come into play, there's been a higher degree of awareness among people, a higher degree of vigilance, a higher degree of courage in order to stand up for what is right, even if their idea of what is right is somehow and somewhat distorted.
But is being aware enough?
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
When you see so many people getting killed all over the place and you don't care, I mean, where's the awareness in that? Awareness what? Because I know what's happening? Is that an awareness? Awareness is me going outside doing something about it, which no one is. I mean, in China, you have the Rohingya Muslims, or I don't know what they're called. Millions of them are in camps. They've been fed alcohol and pig just so they could, you know, take away their Islam away. People in Myanmar are being killed. People all over the world being killed. And people are in terms of in the news, they know what's going on. In terms of who is doing something about it, no one.
Anyone, most of the times, since forever, anyone who could do anything that would warrant a great degree of influence on another nation's actions is the government. All right. We're not talking about governments here. Governments have always been corrupted. And to an extent, the expectations I feel that a lot of us have of humanity nowadays depicts a utopia. Yes, the level of awareness people are having today has led to many campaigns, even hashtags. It's the least someone can do. And they take pride in what they do because they feel like they're contributing.
Much more better. They can take down those systems and government that they live under, that they're subjected to. And they are, you know, dhulm, oppression is happening on a government scale, run by the few. And the majority are just watching. What am I going to do? Hashtag me too. Come on. They got to be more than that. I mean, if you want to take down a system and if you want to put your guts into it, you have to take it to the outside. You can't just, this is actually what's happening to us. We're getting slaughtered easily because, in order for you to raise your concern, send a hashtag, put a comment on, like and subscribe. That's...
That degree of movement that you're talking about, Sayedna,
that just kills
you
slow. That kills your humanity. I'm just going to complain. I'm just going to write a comment, show my anger. If that's what the humanity came down to, then God help us all.
That movement, I feel, needs a righteous, pious, selfless, well-educated, eloquent leadership, which, well, not all countries have the privilege of being blessed with, like, I don't know, Iran maybe. And sometimes the fact that they lack that sort of leadership isn't necessarily their fault, nor does it mean that they lack humanity. At the end of the day, we're all going to criticize the state of human beings because, well, it's not perfect and it's not meant to be perfect until, based on our belief system, Sahib al-Zaman alayhi salam reappears and he establishes that sort of utopia that we all strive for. And until then, sometimes the best a person can do is pray. That doesn't make them any less human, in my opinion. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah, يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the Ummah rise again let us see daylight again once again
IRIB English Radio Thank you.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Under Trump, Title 42 was a pretext to implement draconian immigration policies. But under Biden, it's a management tool to deal with a legitimate problem, says Dorothy Benz, writer, in an article titled, Once Trump's asylum ban became Biden's, corporate media outrage faded away. Stay tuned for more. Facing coronavirus pandemic, Trump suspends immigration laws and showcases vision for lockdown border, a Washington Post headline announced in April 2020, reporting on the administration's invocation of Title 42, a public health code provision that allows the government to take emergency action to prevent communicable disease. The lead explained, President Trump has used emergency powers during the coronavirus pandemic to implement the kind of a strict enforcement regime at the U.S. southern border he has long wanted, suspending laws that protect minors and asylum seekers. Almost exactly 2 years later, the same paper, including one of the same authors of the 2020 article, reported on the coming end of the same policy restrictions with this headline. Biden faces influx of migrants at the border amid calls to lift limits that aided expulsions. Here, the lead said that increasing numbers of migrants and refugees at the border were stirring fears that the Biden administration will face an even larger influx if it lifts pandemic restrictions next week. An end to the Title 42 deportations was announced the following week to go into effect on May 23rd. It's hard to even recognize it as the same policy in these two pieces. It looked at the Washington Post coverage of Title 42. From its introduction to its effects, calls for its end as well as for its continuation, and to its announced end, to track how the paper's reporting changed from the Trump administration to the Biden administration. The differences, which are stark and consistent, reveal something about how the Post views the two administrations, but also a lot about how they analyze, or don't, U.S. immigration policy. Under the Trump administration, the Washington Post consistently framed Title 42 as a pretext for severe restrictions on immigration, rather than presenting it as face value as a legitimate public health measure. The April 3, 2020, the article described the use of Title 42 as a pilot test for the impact of more draconian measures Trump has long advocated. An April 21st Post piece spoke of the pandemic as the reasoning, not the reason, for the restrictions. On May 13th, it attributed to some experts the belief that Title 42 was an excuse to implement the kind of blanket closures President Trump has sought for years.
Moreover, the 2020 coverage regularly included damning evidence supporting the view that the pandemic was merely a pretext for shutting the border, namely the fact that COVID was much worse in the US than anywhere else, and in particular, much worse than in Mexico and Central America. Mexico has confirmed fewer than 1,500 positive cases of the virus so far, less than 1% the number in the United States, one report noted, adding, though Trump administration officials have tried to emphasize the external threat of the virus, the United States continues to have the worst outbreak in the world. Another explained. Despite the administration's claims of an external threat, the United States remains the world's worst coronavirus hotspot by far, the Post told readers. By contrast, in 2021 and 2022, with a different occupant in the White House, Title 42 restrictions were generally contextualized as a response to the pandemic. In a July 2021 piece headlined Along Mexico Border, COVID Spike and More Migrant Families Stall Plans to End Title 42 Expulsions, the claim that public health concerns were driving decisions about whether and when to end Title 42 is taken at face value. The piece goes so far as to rely a story from local Joya, Texas police about a migrant mother sneezing and coughing walking into a fast food restaurant where the Yushians promptly called the police on the family. This is day after day, we get hundreds of people and they could all be sick, the cop quoted. On the day this article ran, Mexico had 13,911 new COVID cases while the U.S. logged 84,961, more than twice as many even on a per capita basis. These numbers, however, were missing from the account. Similarly, in the March of 2022 piece, the Washington Post framed the upcoming decision on whether to continue or end Title 42 restrictions as a public health decision. If the administration chose to continue them, it noted, it would not be the first time the Biden administration opted to renew them as another wave of infection looms. The emergence of the Omicron variant of the coronavirus last winter quashed the speculation that an end to Title 42 was imminent. In April 2020, The Washington Post reported that Title 42 bypassed court-ordered due process protections for minors, asylum seekers, and others, and said that Trump has shelved safeguards intended to protect trafficking victims and persecuted groups. That May, it revealed, the Trump administration's emergency coronavirus restrictions have shut the U.S. immigration system so tight that since March 21st, just two people seeking humanitarian protection at the southern border have been allowed to stay. Such blunt statements about the devastating human rights impact of Title 42 were absent from the coverage in 2021 and 2022, however. In their place, the paper sometimes attributed concerns about dangers to migrants to critics of the policy. Advocates for immigrants have repeatedly sued over the policy, saying it endangers migrants and violates federal law. It reported in March 2022. Democratic lawmakers, civil liberties groups demand end to Title 42 border expulsions. It mentioned that a federal appeals court had days earlier ordered the Biden administration to stop sending families to countries where they face persecution, citing reports that migrants have been raped, tortured, and killed after being expelled. In March 24th article, objective dangers were again couched as partisan opinions. Democrats and immigrant advocates say that the order is denying victims of persecution the right to seek asylum under U.S. law. On March 30, it was activists who argued that Title 42 is an inhumane way to treat people seeking refuge. I don't know, rape, torture, and murder seem objectively inhumane to people. And while Trump's use of Title 42 was described with words like draconian and crackdown, such normative terms were absent when it came to explaining Biden's border policy. In 2020, Title 42 was used to summarily expel migrants, but in 2022, it was used to rapidly deport them. In 2020, the Washington Post was concerned that the border was shut so tight by Title 42 that only two people had gotten humanitarian protection. But in 2022, it worried lifting the policy could swell the border with migrants who view it as easier to come to the United States and claim asylum. Apparently, there is such a thing as too much humanitarian protection. Indeed, the biggest theme of the Biden-era coverage of Title 42 has been the perception that ending the restrictions would result in too many people seeking asylum or otherwise trying to immigrate to the U.S. The quantity of border crossers is now so large that if Title 42 were lifted, agents would not be able to safely detain migrants, especially if large numbers seek asylum, analysts told the Post. In Biden officials bracing for unprecedented strain at Mexico border, if pandemic restrictions lifted, the Post talked about a possible post-Title 42 border rush. Biden officials insist the CDC renewal decision is driven by public health, the March 24th article noted. But in private, border authorities and others say it has become a management tool to cope with the historic migration pressures they have faced since early last year. Under Trump, Title 42 was a pretext to implement draconian immigration policies, but under Biden, it's a management tool to deal with a legitimate problem. Burley unspoken is that the Washington Post now considers it a necessary management tool to stem the influx of people migrating to the U.S. Thus, 2020's concern over shelved safeguards has dissipated, and in its place, we have justifications for continuing the very same policy that 2 years ago was viewed as extreme. And equally predictably, the Post has returned to its habit of legitimizing and stabilizing the U.S. presidency and framing immigration policy as part of a chess match between Democrats and Republicans. Underlying the reflex to defend the administration is an unexamined bias in favor of U.S. racist immigration and border agencies. Border policies, the policies that have overall been the same before, during, and after Trump administration. As border crossings increased in the second year of the pandemic, Republicans, Democrats, and the Washington Post are all in the agreement that shelving human rights concerns is the price of keeping unwanted refugees and migrants out of the U.S.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.